Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. This is Ron Edwards, coming to you from the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. Minneapolis, that is, a city under siege. Tonight we're going to take a look at, for first, the international scene. We're going to take a look briefly at Chicago, and then we are going to bring you to the city of Minneapolis, a city on the edge. The metropolitan area here, though, is also on the edge, particularly after the shooting of five African Americans on Monday evening by right-wing extremists, neo-Nazis, responding to what they consider to be offensive actions against law enforcement here in the city of Minneapolis. We will go into some specific detail, starting back with the events that led to the death of a 24-year-old African-American in this city that we talked about on last week's program. First of all, though, we want to take a look at the continued problems in the Middle East. When the Russian fighter jet, actually a fighter bomber, Su-24, was shot down, and of course there's a great dispute if it was in Syrian or Turkish territory, two Turkish F-16 jets shot that aircraft down, and we now have a situation that if there's a miscalculation, a misstep, a quote-unquote misinterpretation of what the other side is doing, we could find ourselves embroiled in a serious conflict militarily in the Middle East, where sometimes you need a scorecard to determine who all the actors are and who's on whose side and who's had a falling out with who and who used to be whose enemy and now is whose friend, and et cetera. It is a very confusing situation. But it is a dangerous situation, and it does affect us here in the United States because it is America's sons and daughters that will be called into combat. This situation continues to escalate. You know, the United States allegedly has 50, which makes you kind of wonder what are 50 individuals going to do against upwards of 25,000 troops on the ground, if you will, from the different factions, be they Al-Qaeda or whomever, if you will. America's air power is what has been at play for over a year. I think the president today indicated that the United States has flown over 8,000 sorties, if you will, dropped hundreds of thousands of tons of bombs, killed a lot of civilians, but then civilians are seen as merely collateral damage, and particularly people of color are not that important in these conflicts around the world, and particularly in the Middle East. But the Russians bring a different perspective to the table. They are very much engaged, if you will, and contrary to what people try to do in dismissing the Russian military presence and military might, Russia does have an effective and extremely dangerous military force and are able to conduct the kind of operations that could take a lot of lives, if you will. Would suggest to those that like to follow all of the events across the world, the world's affairs and etc., that one keeps an eye on Syria, Iraq, if you will, now what's being played out along the Turkish-Syrian border, and even the Iraqi-Turkish border, if you will. Of course, Turkey, a member of NATO, who is expecting the NATO countries to protect, if you will, side with and support whatever articulation the Turkish government makes with regards to the situation involving Russia, Syria, and the proxies that are involved. And also we have to say Iran, because there has been formed a triad, if you will, Russia, Iran, Syria, and certainly Hezbollah, which is really the military force in Libya. And so we watch all of that with a very cautious eye and a very sensitive ear with regards to that particular conflict. Let me say something we said a long time ago about Vladimir Putin. He is not a weak person, or as the brothers like to say on the street, he is not a punk. And he is a trained intelligence officer, being a colonel, having been a colonel in the KGB, if you will, and is a man who prides himself on knowing and understanding all of the arts and crafts, if you will, of power, conflict, and etc. If one is not able to kind of get him to settle down a little bit and analyze what is happening, though he is analyzing what it is that he is going to do to deal with his anger and the anger of the Russian people. You have to understand, Russia lost a commercial aircraft with 224 souls aboard over the Sinai in a situation in which the culprits have not been specifically identified, though there is great suspicion that ISIL or ISIL's proxies in the Sinai were involved in placing a explosive device upon that aircraft that went down, as we said a couple weeks ago, with 224 human beings, basically all Russian, aboard. And so with this latest situation of a Russian fighter bomber jet being shot down, you know, and one of the two aviators shot and killed, execution style, if you will. The other one, interesting enough, survived after being picked up by Russian special forces who went in with helicopters and et cetera and retrieved the navigator, if you will. One has to keep an eye on just how volatile that situation will become. And, of course, President Barack Obama plays a significant role with the United States being considered to be a significant player and significant power broker in that part of the world. So we keep our eye on that. Turning our attention to the local and domestic scenes, people across the country are talking about Chicago, talking about the death of a young man 16 months ago. Took a long time for some semblance of at least inquiry in the pursuit of justice to take place. But a district court judge in Chicago 2 days ago indicated that the city of Chicago and the police department were going to have to give up the video of the death of this young man on the streets of downtown Chicago. It was right there on the edge of downtown Chicago. And the video has gone absolutely viral, even though, and this was interesting, there was a $5 million settlement very, very quickly, quicker than normal in situations like that, a wrongful death, with the family of the 17-year-old deceased. $5 million. That's an interesting number, but then when one sees the video, and when one sees a human being being shot 16 times with a revolver, not an automatic rifle, if you will, or et cetera, with a handgun in which you must squeeze off a shot, quote unquote, at a time. 16 shots fired in about 16 seconds, if you will. This young man riddled. His life exterminated out of him, if you will. And so headline on a number of papers, Chicago officer is charged in teen's death. By the way, the state's attorney in Chicago asking for a first-degree murder charge and conviction, if you will, kind of unusual, as a number of people have said over the last couple of hours, in the last, 36 hours. We are looking here in studio at some of the reflections and statements made around the country about this situation as it pertains to the death of the 17-year-old Mr. McDonald. His crime, allegedly, that he 911 calls had been made, that he was acting in a kind of destructive manner, allegedly breaking in cars, puncturing tires. That's what they said that he was doing. There seems to be no video of that, by the way, but certainly there is video, very graphic video, of his execution, because that was an execution, my friends. However you try to twist it, as it pertains to those who maintain that his actions brought about his death, the fact of the matter is that Officer Jason Van Dyke executed Mr. McDonald on the streets of Chicago, an American city, by shooting him 16 times. In fact, the testimony before a grand jury, one of the officers, or at least I think eight officers that were there, no other officer fired his weapon, or her weapon, if you will. One of the officers was bold enough to give testimony that not a single other officer fired their weapon, and that they did not feel that they were in jeopardy or their lives were threatened by whatever the actions of Mr. McDonald were. In fact, in the video, he is moving away from the officer as the first two shots hit him. In fact, at one point, let's say 9 seconds to 10 seconds into the video, you can see what clearly was a shot going through him in what we call in and out, if you will, through and through, as you could see dust behind him. That probably was a bullet that went in through his shoulder, his chest, and came out the other side, hitting the ground and probably ricocheting. Terrible situation, situation totally uncalled for, but that's what happens when we live in a society that sees us as African Americans as less than human. I mean, that's clearly what is at play. It has been at play even long before Ferguson. You know, we use Ferguson now as the example, if you will, but the fact of the matter is, for those of us that have been around and involved and are historians and actual participants and activists, that these kinds of situations have been around for a long time. What has happened, the emergence of cyber, if you will, of telephone cameras and videos and et cetera, has made it more frequently that we are confronted. I have to tell you that, you know, in the 1960s, as an example, black folks were being killed in the same kind of situations and numbers. We just didn't have, quote-unquote, the photographic evidence that we have today, if you will, where everybody has their phone video up, ready to go, and et cetera, and in some cases, it proves to be invaluable. In fact, as an example, in North Charleston, South Carolina, this past summer, if it had not been for a very courageous individual who the officer did not see recording the death of Walter Scott, we would have had a different scenario. Walter Scott, as clearly we all remember, those that are for real, being shot 8 times in the back by a North Charleston police officer, and this was before the brutal murder and execution of 9 beautiful black souls at Mother Emanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina. North Charleston, quote-unquote, a rather large suburb of Charleston, if you will. And so, in the situation and in the circumstances surrounding the death of Mr. McDonald, it, for those of us that are longtime activists, if you will, and particularly as this commentator who has been involved in some very high-profile police shootings of human beings, primarily African Americans in this city, for over 50 years, we are not immune, if you will. We do not dismiss, we are not cavalier, and et cetera. But you make a certain adjustment in your psyche, if you will, as you see these things happen, as you see the pain and the bitterness and the anger that emerges when one of these situations takes place. And this past Sunday, the edition of the Minneapolis Star Tribune, the largest newspaper here in the state of Minnesota, we were quoted as indicating that nothing has changed other than the name of the victim and the name of the perpetrators. And that was a difficult statement for me to make, per se, in Sunday morning's edition of the Star Tribune, because one wants to be sensitive. One wants to take into consideration the heartache and the pain being felt by the loved ones of victim or victims, if you will. But at some point, it has to be the realism that has to be conveyed, that one has been there and has seen these situations happen time and time and time and time and time again. In this state, by the way, now moving to our own local situation, and by the way, for those who are asking the question, I've received numerous calls over the last 10 to 11 days of what the situation is here, and certainly received a lot of calls since Monday evening at approximately 10:45 p.m. Central Standard Time, just how volatile is the situation here in Minneapolis and of course, the Twin Cities. It is extremely volatile. There are serious allegations being made, which I maintain that the offer of proof has not been presented. And I repeat again, the offer of proof has not been presented that the Minneapolis police were involved with the actions of, quote-unquote, four neo-Nazi supremacists, well-armed. In fact, was talking with a friend, a couple friends today, and one of the things that I realized that they did not know, that and even here, our own local paper, in their copyrighted story in this morning's edition, because of the time of the event on Monday, the Tuesday edition of the paper here in these cities had rendered the story on the back page, the B section of the paper. This morning's paper was, of course, the sensational, in fact, the headline in the Star Tribune this morning, Wednesday, November 25th, 2015, shootings heighten outrage. Three are in custody after attack on Black Lives Matter protesters. Yes. But I'm not sure, by the way, that all five of the individuals that were shot, as an example, were actually Black Lives Matter members, but they were members of the African-American community and clearly were ambushed. It is a difficult time. A lot of politics are being played here, and a lot of dangerous actions are being taken, and not only the shooting, if you will, by well-armed, if you will, and well-trained white vigilantes. As we said, you are, as example, not being told that these individuals who said that they were just guys coming out to see what was going on were all wearing body armor and carrying light weapons, if you will, handguns and short-barreled automatic weapons, if you will. Their actions were being coordinated by a United States Marine reservist, if you will. It appears, according to sources available to this commentator, that all four of the individuals had permits to carry. We have our laws here in the state of Minnesota. There's, of course, a large, large number and preponderance of Caucasians. Though one of the four is identified as a Latino, if you will, but also has a background in paramilitary actions and et cetera. In fact, there is reason to believe that these individuals are really a death squad that have been functioning for a period of time in the immediate area and very well have been involved in training in southern Missouri. Where there are a number, in fact, it's interesting. We've been talking for a number of years about the training facilities of white extremists here in the United States in a place called Sandpoint, Idaho. For those that are there on their computers, you can call it up. Sandpoint, rugged mountain country up there in northern Idaho, but it is a hotbed of facilitation, of training, and preparing for, quote-unquote, the race war, as Dylan Root, the man who gunned down 9 African-Americans. You know, you don't even hear anything about Dylan Root, do you? No one gives you any in-depth analysis of who his guardians, quote-unquote, were. When I say guardians, I'm talking about those that, quote-unquote, developed his hatred, if you will, radicalized him. So you never hear anybody talking about white folks being radicalized, if you will. The radicalization, if you will, is concentrated on people of color. But I have to tell you that these individuals, these 4 individuals, and they are more involved. And by the way, an extension was granted by the district court here earlier today, holding them until at least apparently Monday morning. But at that point, the gunman must be released. But I want to come back just a little bit to the training facilities that are providing so many of these individuals who are now on the streets and in the countryside, if you will, well-trained, well-motivated, if you will, have totally been psychologically conditioned to carry out the kind of acts of terror. In fact, we had a situation here yesterday where the officials, not the chief, but the officials of city government directed that any reference to the race of the gunman be omitted from press releases and et cetera. Yet we have no problem when there is allegations of misconduct and activities against a African-American to quickly identify them as black or use the code words. A lot of people haven't figured it out. Richard Sherman of the Seattle Seahawks a couple years ago did a beautiful job doing an interview after the Super Bowl victory by the Seahawks a couple years ago when he checked a white female reporter who was talking about thugs. We all know in black America that the word thugs is a code word for African-Americans. It's just kind of a substitute for NIG, if you know what I mean. But now there are other kinds of terms that are being used to, quote-unquote, identify African-Americans and et cetera. And basically, no matter where you're at, be it Columbus, Ohio, or Detroit, Michigan, or Portland, Oregon, or Phoenix, Arizona, Orlando, Florida, etc., you always can tell when they're talking about an African-American when they talk in terms of gang affiliation. Now, the 4 terrorists in this city and in the events of this past Monday night are clearly terrorists, just as Dylan Root was a lone wolf terrorist when he executed 9 African-Americans in a black church in Charleston, South Carolina. And yet also the Minneapolis Star Tribune, other than quoting individuals who made reference to the fact that these men were acting as terrorists, did not identify them as being individuals that are affiliated with terrorist groups. In fact, in the course of a raid yesterday by SWAT teams from the Minneapolis and Bloomington police departments, Bloomington being a large suburb to the south of Minneapolis, went into the home of the leader, quote-unquote, of the group, according to intel and et cetera, and found a significant arms store, if you will, a lot of weapons, if you will, explosives and detonators and et cetera. We had reported just a week ago on these programs that both they and the anarchists, who are of opposite philosophical views, had, quote-unquote, been looking for bomb makers, if you will. That is how serious the situation has become here in the city of Minneapolis. And so it was interesting yesterday and late Monday, very late Monday, when there was this confusion and political back and forth that they did not want to identify the race, even though some of us had been provided with videos of the white terrorists as they were doing recon. I want to use the military, proper military language. They had actually been seen in the area around the 4th Precinct Station on Morgan and Plymouth Avenue North in Minneapolis on both Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And we were sent a text and a video of two of them as they kind of, you know, moved around and moved through the groups and et cetera. The masks were not necessarily totally out of order. The temperature had began to drop a little bit. It was wet and rainy and et cetera. But it was after the anarchists last Wednesday opened fire and fired at the police station, the 4th Precinct, as well as through petrol bombs, gasoline bombs, and et cetera, at police and police squad cars parked in the back parking lot of the 4th Precinct, that folks started becoming concerned. But no one except the Homeland Security, FBI, the Minneapolis Police Department were aware that they had intercepted, I repeat that again, they had intercepted electronic transmissions, including videos of the conspirators, the white terrorists, if you will, the neo-Nazis, the white supremacists, meeting and discussing their operation, if you will. As we said earlier on this program, it was a well-coordinated operation. These fellas came to the table knowing what it is that they needed to do. Now, this takes us back to Missouri. This takes us back to a couple places down around the Ozarks, if you will. And it's two specific cities, or actually a little towns, if you will, that are in between. Actually, there's three. Let's do it like this. Marshfield, Missouri, which is there on Highway 44, which comes down from St. Louis down to Springfield and on towards Tulsa and et cetera. There is Mansfield, Missouri, but in between is a place called Seymour. Seymour, Missouri, interesting place. I think that if the county attorney here, Mike Freeman, was really interested in charging these individuals, he would take a look at some of their travel itineraries, if you will, and he would take a look at their activities in southern Missouri. And by the way, they weren't going down to Bronson, Missouri, to listen to some good old country western music, if you know what I mean. They had something much more in mind, and that included their training and et cetera. In fact, I remember a situation, just as an aside, that happened to the east of these survivalist camps. It happened, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, just north of Blytheville, Arkansas. And it had actually started, if you will, in Caruthersville, Missouri, when a group of white separatists there began to chase a group of Negroes, quote-unquote, blacks, quote-unquote. And just outside of Blytheville, Arkansas, a young African-American was caught up with and apprehended by vigilantes operating out of Caruthersville and et cetera, and he was murdered. He was, you know, beaten, thrown into a reservoir. In fact, at one point, his family and mother and others cried out for justice, but what they found out was that the local NAACP in Blytheville, Arkansas, was being directed by a agent provocateur who was working with the sheriff there in that county, where Blytheville is the county seat, and helped cover up the circumstances of the death of that young African-American. Now, the reason that we talk about that is that the individuals involved back then in that activity are part of a specific group of individuals that we talked about on these programs last summer when we were following the events in Ferguson, Missouri, St. Louis County, and St. Louis City. And, in fact, probably next week we will talk to an expert that we have been utilizing as it pertains to the race events in Missouri. But we want to suggest that, again, we will repeat ourselves. We want to suggest that the county attorney here, Mike Freeman, needs to take a look at the, we repeat it again, just like we said it the first time, the travel itinerary of these white supremacists who were involved in the shooting. They did not kill anyone. We want to be as transparent as possible, my friends. But they wounded 5 African Americans. And they were bold, if you will. I mean, they walked right in the midst of these demonstrators and et cetera. What is disturbing is that the head of the Black Lives Matter, who is also the head of the local branch of the NAACP, apparently had not done the kind of preparation that she needed to do, particularly in that she is a professor of law at St. Thomas College here in the Twin Cities, that she did not have her people prepared for the fact that there were right-wing extremists on the move and preparing and planning. Yet she, as an officer of the court, and I want to repeat that, as an officer of the court, had been told by the Minneapolis Police Department, by the FBI, by Homeland Security, that an active plan was in play. And also, as I understand it, and that everybody's talking about they want to see videos, was given some limited access to the videos that were, quote-unquote, being recorded by, quote-unquote, individuals who may have been double agents, if you know what I mean. And so the leadership of Black Lives Matter and / the NAACP, which are, quote-unquote, one and the same at this particular point, were well advised. In other words, the Minneapolis Police Department and the federal authorities and state authorities had been due diligent in indicating that there was a clear and present danger. That is a law enforcement term, military term. Some may have remembered seeing it in a movie, but the movie extracted that particular term, clear and present danger, from the Big Book, as we like to call it. And so as these right-wing paramilitary have been moving in and coming into Minnesota, and they are now well entrenched, if you will. It will only be because authorities here put pressure on them that there will not be recurring incidents of violence against protesters. But more importantly, into my concern as a resident of the city of Minneapolis, is that our people, African-Americans, are extremely vulnerable to what is a well-designed and well-motivated and well-driven conspiracy of very, very, very dangerous individuals who have decided that it is time to initiate the race war. In fact, here in Minnesota, we stay as far away as we possibly can from talking about race war, though we know that there are active groups. We repeat that again. See, we would probably not be able to have this discussion tonight here on this program if not for that headline in a white paper, the largest paper in the state, "Shootings Heighten Outrage." Now, normally people would like to say that the shootings must have been black-on-black crime, black folk acting up, and et cetera. No. In fact, here's what also happened and how well this situation was planned. During the course of preparation for this carnage, the white supremacists had already figured out the psychological mindset of many of the protesters. And what they did on Monday evening, after standing in front of a home on the 1300 block of Morgan, discussing their actions and then redeploying their fellow gunmen, they made sure that they came into full view of a group of African Americans who really were not necessarily being as vigilant as they should have. And when the white supremacists were approached, they knew just what to do. And one of the first things they did when asked why they were there was to indicate that it wasn't any of the, and I have to use this word, this is blog radio, so we have the latitude to do it, that they were watching what the niggers were doing. Now, that was a triggering word. But I have to tell you, my friends, that these assassins, these terrorists, knew that that would be a triggering word, that that would get the kind of results that they needed. And so for a brief moment, there was hand-to-hand combat along the 1300, moving up to the 1400 block of Morgan Avenue North. In other words, moving up from and away from the police station, the 4th Precinct Station, where probably about at that time, probably 85 to 90 protesters were still gathering, not paying any attention. Once they came across 14th and Morgan, then other gunmen emerged from their hiding places, and they then opened fire. Of course, the African Americans, five of whom were wounded, were not prepared for that kind of physical confrontation and began to flee. The gunmen continued firing. Luckily, innocent people were not hit. They then got into their vehicles and drove off. Now, a little bit later, they were in consultation. They, being the white supremacists, were in consultation with their attorneys. See how well we are laying out to you. They had this planned. They knew just what it was they were going to do, and they also knew the kind of protection that they were going to receive from the system. They were in consultation with their attorneys. They laid out what happened. They laid out how the African Americans, five of whom were to become victims of the gunfire, responded, if you will, that there was an attack upon them, the white supremacists. There was hand-to-hand combat, if you will, that they attempted to move away and flee, which was a very clever move, from these black savages, if you will, these thugs and et cetera, but had no choice at that point but to, quote-unquote, engage in self-defense. Now, what has happened here in the Twin Cities is that the county attorney, on yesterday, about 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, indicated to the Minneapolis Police Department, who is still investigating the case and trying to find if there are other co-conspirators and et cetera, was basically told that based on, and this was kind of hurtful to our community, that based on testimony, statements, affidavits given by some of those African Americans that participated in the physical hand-to-hand confrontation and their declarations that they had taken on these white guys and attacked them and et cetera, that the attorneys, very quietly, for the white supremacists, conveyed to the county attorney, Mike Freeman, that this was an issue of self-defense and cited a precedent, legal precedent, as it pertains to the issue of self-defense, if you will. And so within, you know, 4 or 5 hours after bringing these individuals in, oh, by the way, two of the individuals actually surrendered, came in apparently with their attorneys, though this morning's edition of the Star Tribune does not detail that for you, but they came in with their attorneys. And so their legal teams, think about that, my friends. These are white terrorists, if you will, some with military experience, some with excellent training, men who came to a gathering in which, quote-unquote, those present were hostile, if you will, and foreign to the philosophy and the doctrine of these neo-Nazis. Yet they came to their place of gathering, if you will, armed, with a plan, and wearing body armor with extra ammunition and et cetera. They were prepared to stay for the duration, if you will. It's just a matter of how a conflict like that emerges. Now, some of these things, these individuals, had been trained on as a part of this squad, if you will. We identified them earlier as commandos, and that's how they are identified. And they are identified like that in some of the electronic intercepts by government agencies, if you will. They consider themselves to be commandos. They had all kinds of interesting things for the different websites and et cetera that they were operating out of. In fact, the person identified as Latino Hispanic was very much involved in being the technician, the IT, if you will, the informational technician, and etc. Now, this morning's edition of the paper, given that there had been at least 38 hours of probing, if you will, and additional examination, that these reflections are not shown. Now, we are aware here in this city, and we are certainly aware on this program, that the decision conveyed to the MPD yesterday by the county attorney, the Hennepin County attorney, that they did not see any prima facie that would allow them to charge this commando group with quote-unquote assault, intent to kill, conspiracy, and et cetera. That's amazing, particularly when you talk about the conspiracy, because as we said, the county attorney here knows that the Minneapolis Police Department on the dates of the 15th, 16th, 17th, 18th, and 19th of November, because they wanted to be due diligent, if you will, and proactive, had made sure that copies of the intercepts, the audio and video transmissions and et cetera, were made available in the right circles, because they were desperately seeking to find these individuals out. In fact, it was the due diligence of the Minneapolis Police Department under Chief Janae Harto, who is under unmerciful attack for, quote-unquote, not being sensitive to what is happening after the death of Mr. Clark, Jamar Clark, who was laid to rest this afternoon in our city, that she was not sensitive, and yet she and her department did everything they could to alert the authorities that these individuals, and as we said earlier, there were pictures of them with their mask on, if you will. They were wearing ski masks, if you will. So you could tell enough about them that they were Caucasian. And yet, in the last 24 hours, the county attorney in our beloved state of Minnesota has said, we just don't have enough prima facie, enough presence of evidence, to charge these guys. Now, the scheme here is to allow them to be released and disappear, if you will. There's not been a lot of reflection and discussion, by the way, about what was found in that house in Bloomington, as SWAT teams from both the Minneapolis and Bloomington police departments stormed that house. That becomes crucial because the rumor is that some of the weapons in that house were weapons that had been stolen, as we said earlier at the top of this program, from Army depots around the Midwest area. And we have reason to believe that some of the ammunition and et cetera had been provided to them by the white extremist groups operating out of Sandpoint, Idaho. Now, we're not sure what the county attorney will do as we move towards the last 12 or 13 minutes of tonight's program. One cannot predict. We do know that the county attorney knows that there are some of us are aware of the decision that has been conveyed to the Minneapolis Police Department, that the county attorney does not see enough prima facie, presence of evidence, to charge these individuals. Now, that then takes us to the U.S. attorney for the Federal District of Minnesota, Andy Lugar, who has gained a significant reputation with regards to the roundup of Muslims, particularly Somalis here in the state of Minnesota. And they have been receiving, both male and female, for the last couple of years, have been receiving stiff sentencing for conspiracy, if you will, for the facilitation of terrorist activities, for relationships with terrorist groups and organizations, et cetera, et cetera, and et cetera. And yet, all of a sudden, we have white extremists, dangerous, dangerous, dangerous people, well-trained and et cetera, who are bold enough to go into the midst, as we said earlier, of groups of people who they are absolutely hostile to, who they find to be repugnant and without purpose of life. Notice the term that we use, without purpose of life. And yet the system all of a sudden cannot figure out how it is that they can deal with the criminality of these individuals. Isn't that fascinating? I mean, these are people, as we said just minutes ago, who have been putting a significant number of Muslims, particularly Somalis in this state, away, if you will. I mean, they are bringing them in as part of a large conspiracy, if you will, as many as 7, 8, or 9, if you will. We have Somali women a couple of years ago being sentenced to 15, 20, 30, 40 years in the penitentiary for facilitation with known, quote-unquote, terrorist groups by sending monies and et cetera to groups overseas. We have young Somali/Muslim men who are, quote-unquote, getting ready to serve up to 40 years in the penitentiary because they decided they wanted to go to Syria to fight, quote-unquote, against Western imperialism. I mean, I understand, as a commentator, but more importantly as a historian, you know, what the hypothesis and what the theory is and et cetera. But I would think that we would want to, in order to show the rest of the world how magnanimous we are, that we would want to be balanced in the administration of justice, quote-unquote, and punishment, if you will. Now, I'm saying again, for the second time within an 8-9 minute period of time, that it will be interesting to see if the county attorney sees fit to charge these capital crimes, if you will. Now, we're not talking about some guys that were handing out some leaflets and maybe were involved in the exchange of some cursing and profanity and et cetera. We're talking about individuals who planned, plotted, coordinated, armed themselves, and had backup plans and came into the midst of a group of protesters, lured them into ambush, and then proceeded to shoot 5 of them, if you will. And then were legally smart enough, keen enough, to surrender themselves after they realized that their leader had quote-unquote, been apprehended at his fortress in the city of Bloomington with the arsenal, came in with their attorneys and indicated that, yes, we were involved, they were involved in the incident a number of hours prior, if you will, maybe 10, 12 hours earlier. And that the reason, though, that it happened was because they were set upon by these quote-unquote thugs, if you will, and they had to protect themselves. Now, we repeat what we said just a couple minutes ago. You know, anytime you decide to go to a situation, number one, you're armed, but number two, you understand what combat means when you put body armor on. Okay, think about that, particularly for those of you that military, either formally or currently or et cetera, or even those of you that like to watch TV programs and talk and listen to these CSI movies and these Black Mass and another, all of these good movies and et cetera produced in Hollywood or wherever else. But you think about that. Now, how is that not a symbol of what is called prima facie? Again, the presence of evidence, if you will. How is that not enough to invoke those statutes and provisions which can be used on the other side of the racial aisle, if you will? I mean, think about what we said earlier. These young Muslim men here in the Twin Cities and in Columbus, Ohio, Portland, Oregon, Seattle, and et cetera, young men who take a bus and go to New York and try to get on an airplane to fly to Syria, and they are detained, if you will, and later charged with a multiplicity of statutory, quote-unquote, laws and et cetera that indicate that they have done wrong, they have committed a felony, and they must be held accountable for their actions, and they are being held accountable. In fact, they are now being double tried, which raises the question of double jeopardy. They've already been sentenced for facilitation and et cetera, but now They are being charged with additional conspiracy under the Terrorism Act and etc. That's why, earlier in this program, we went to great lengths to talk in terms of how certain references are not made. Terrorist, if you will, white terrorists, neo-Nazis, if you will, conspiracy, videos which captured, quote-unquote, them planning this attack on African-Americans primarily, if you will. That in itself is enough of a prima facie to at least charge you, quote-unquote, with conspiring to commit bodily harm and to commit murder, mayhem and injury, assault, and etc. And yet the word is out tonight in our beloved city that our powerful, powerful county attorney, we haven't heard anything, and I doubt that we will from the U.S. Attorney for the Federal District of Minnesota. We have heard nothing that would indicate that in the case of the feds that they're even interested in really examining, vetting these very well-trained, we repeat that again, well-trained down there in Missouri, and we think that a couple of them actually went to the very top-notch extremist facility at Sandpoint, Idaho, along the Spirit River and Spirit Lake. Excellent, excellent training grounds up there. And the government has known about that for a long time. In fact, it was from there that came the individuals who attempted to bomb the Martin Luther King Day celebration in Spokane, Washington, about 5 years ago. See, people tend to want to forget about that. Yes, that's for those of you that didn't pay any attention when white extremists almost pulled off a serious military-style action and carnage when they attempted to set off a, and this was rather interesting because folks don't talk about that either, a dirty bomb, as we like to call it, with both biological and other kinds of materials. If it had not been for the alertness of Spokane City workers, if you will, who saw the suitcase under a bus stop bench, that bomb would have been detonated, and anywhere from 200 to 300 to 400 people in Spokane, Washington, would have been killed in that particular situation. Now, what was interesting is that some of the materials that were being used for that bomb had been manufactured in a mountain retreat about 105 miles west of Spokane, Washington, but the materials had been stolen from the United States Army's very large military complex at Fort Lewis, Washington, if you will. For those of you that have served in the United States Armed Forces, particularly Army, you've taken basic training and other kind of training there. For those of you that were in the Far East and et cetera, that is one of the points of debarkation and et cetera. So there are you, those of you out there that know that this commentator knows and understands what this is all about, where these individuals are trained. We repeat again, though, this particular commando unit, which was very effective in what they did and how they carried it out, were trained in the heartland of the Ozarks, in areas that are known, particularly in light of events that happened last year after the so-called Ferguson situation allegedly was laid to rest, if you will, when at least two young African-Americans were shot and killed mysteriously, quote-unquote, one in St. Louis County, the other one in St. Louis City, if you will. The authorities have known about these camps in southern Missouri, just like folks know about some of the survivalist camps here in northern Minnesota. So the purpose of tonight's program is to give food for thought and attempt to educate our people as best we can that the preparation for a race war is in place, that elements of the extreme right, be they the neo-Nazi party, white supremacists, if you will, Americans, white Americans for America, and any other Pacific groups in places all over the map, if you will, that because white media is not telling it does not mean that there are black people out here who, quote-unquote, are devoid of the information and the knowledge. It is important that we understand that what happened in this city on Monday evening at 10:45 p.m. Central Standard Time along the 13 and 1400 block of Morgan Avenue North was not something that was just a response to, quote-unquote, a conversation and mean-spirited exchange of words between two groups of individuals, one black, one white. This was a well-coordinated military-style action intended to establish fear and at the same time retaliation within, quote-unquote, the African-American community. It was an expression of the anger that is being felt by those who maintain that the African-American is not showing the kind of proper respect, quote-unquote, to the dominant and privileged class in this country, white America. We think that that's insane, but it is not beyond the pale with regards to what people are thinking, the anger that is at play. We have heard the president of the Police Federation here make some rather interesting comments, and in fact, in one of the intercepts, electronic intercepts, this special right-wing terror commando group indicated that they thought that that was a signal from the head of the Police Federation that it was time to act in defense of white rights in the city of Minneapolis and by extension white rights in America. You see, we are kind of nervous and scared and skittish as people of color about these types of scenarios, these types of actions, this type of threat to our well-being and to our safety. We should not be, we must not be. If we are going to survive and not be referred to down the line as that race or group of people who are now extinct, we better get on top of our game because they are on top of theirs. And for our national and international audience, what we saw happen here on Monday in the city of Minneapolis was a prelude, was an advanced review of what is being planned as the forces of nullification and reversal now feel that they must move and that they have been empowered to take action by any means necessary to deal with what they consider to be the Negro problem in America. We appreciate the opportunity to have come into your homes via your sets and et cetera. Our associate, Mr. Allen, who is on holiday, will be back with us next week. And we will, unfortunately, be continuing to take a look at what is happening and how it is happening with regards to the question of race and a city which considers itself to be so liberal in everything that it says it's about and everything that it says it wants to be about, that we have become, quote-unquote, the citadel and the signal for every white supremacist group in the United States of America. May God continue to keep his hand on the shoulder of the African-American population, for we, if not careful, are about to become an endangered species. Thank you for allowing us to come into your homes via your computer and cyber network. And may God continue to protect the sons and daughters of the African. This is Ari Edwards. This is the Don and Ron program coming to you from the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. Good evening.